Okay. Welcome back. Just remind everybody to turn off your cell phones or turn off your ringers anyways. And before we get started, I just wanted to make a few remarks. As most of you know, we lost a friend last week, John Nelson. And so I'd like to propose that we dedicate this meeting in memory of John and just ask for a moment of silence. I have a couple of announcements related to the agenda. Tomorrow morning at 8:30, Dr. Jane Lubchenco is going to attend our meeting. I believe that she has some remarks she'd like to make relative to the interim rule. And I'm not sure how long she's going to be with us, but I understand, speaking with her staff this morning, that I'm going to leave some time available for questions and answers as well. So put on your thinking caps, come up with some good questions. I believe Dr. Murawski is also going to attend to answer any technical questions we may have relative to the interim rule. So that's tomorrow at 8:30, which will pack an already packed agenda, but we'll accommodate that. Secondly, today we are scheduled to have a discussion at 1 o'clock under the groundfish concerning the mixed stock exception and the Framework 42 lawsuit. It's back again for comment. Depending upon whether or not Doug Grout and Pat Kirkle are back, they're attending John's funeral this morning. If they're back in time, we'll take the discussion in order on the agenda. Otherwise, I propose we may want to flip-flop the interspecies discussion and the mixed stock discussion. Any objections? Okay. Any council member wish to add or delete anything from the agenda as written? Okay. Just another note, as you notice, we have a new sound system, and I've been told that we need to be careful about pulling it forward because you'll probably unplug yourself. So I know that may be something you want to do, but anyways, just treat it gingerly. It seems to be working well now. So we'll get right on to reports. And I'm going to hold my remarks to the end. So, Paul, if you have anything.
Thank you, just Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things. One, council members, please note that you've made a couple changes to our policy handbook, operations handbook. And in the mail next week, you'll be getting a completely new handbook with those changes, and we've kind of reformatted it. But there was a new SSC policy that you approved, so you'll be getting a new handbook in the mail. Secondly, for the public, our policy for receiving public comment for the agendas is three business days before the council meeting. So that's Thursday afternoon by close of business. And we get tons of stuff in the Monday before the council meeting, and what we try to do that we're not going to do any longer is on controversial items, we try to get everyone's input into the binder, extra copyings, extra time to do the binder, and we try to get it on our web page, but it doesn't do us any good to have a policy and not follow it. So we're going to announce it today that it's listed in every council meeting agenda that if you want material copied for the council members, and if you want it placed on our web page so the whole public can see what the council members see, it has to be in by Thursday close of business no exceptions, okay? And that'll be in our council mailing as well. So that means that if what we'll try to do is if someone does submit a letter or something to us, we'll try to notify them that if they want the council to see it, they're going to have to bring copies for all council members to the meeting on that Tuesday. Now, at the same time that I've said that, I want to discourage that. We also get an awful lot of letters that are presented to the council members at a meeting, probably 10 or 15 on controversial subjects. And quite frankly, in the middle of a meeting, you can't expect the council members to read 10 or 15 letters. So if you want council members to read your input, you have to get it in before Thursday close of business. Now, you know, we'll continue to hand out material to council members at the meeting, but quite frankly, they're not going to read it, or most of them won't have the time to read it because they're engaged in the meeting. So I encourage you to meet our policy deadlines Thursday, close of business. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Paul? George Darcy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you noted, Pat Kirkle will be here this afternoon. She's asked me to give the RA's report for her, which I will do. I think you all are aware by now that the agency released the final interim rule for the 2009 fishing year for the groundfish fishery yesterday. The rule itself is expected to publish on April 13th, next Monday. There will be a 60-day public comment period on that, particularly since the final rule as published differs significantly from what was proposed. It much more closely resembles the council's recommendations for interim measures and will be effective, May 1st through October 28th, at which time we expect to extend it through the remainder of the 2009 fishing year. Although it won't officially publish until the 13th, the text of the rule is has been posted on our website. If you want to look at the text, it's a substantial rule. I think it's 127 pages long. Has responses to 88 public comments and explains all of the measures and the reasons for them. The EA that accompanied that also is posted on that website. I'll just run down some of the primary measures so that that you're all aware of them. The 18% days at sea reduction that was put in place as a default by Amendment 13 will be implemented. It's not part of this rule per se, but the rule doesn't stop that from kicking into place on May 1st. There will be a slightly expanded 2-for-1 days at sea differential counting area in southern New England. The differential counting area in the Gulf of Maine is unchanged. Possession of southern New England winter flounder, ocean pout, and northern windowpane flounder are prohibited. There will be a new trip limit of 1,000 pounds, up to 5,000 pounds per trip for which flounder. There are recreational measures that extend by 2 weeks the seasonal prohibition on retention of Gulf of Maine cod and prohibits retention of southern New England winter flounder, and also sets a Georges Bank cod trip limit of 10 cod per person per day for recreational vessels. It also implements several mitigation measures, including expansion of the closed area one hook gear haddock sap, several modifications, just days at sea leasing and transfer programs to provide greater flexibility. It extends the U.S.-Canada haddock sap, which was due to expire on April 30th, and it lowers the haddock minimum size to 18 inches. Again, I urge you, if you want details, to go to our website, because there's a lot more explanation of why we've done what we've done and the implications of it, and also in the EA. Regarding the Framework 42 measures for groundfish that were temporarily suspended, that meaning the differential days at sea counting aspects of Framework 42. The court temporarily suspended those through April 10th, which is this Friday. This afternoon, you're going to be discussing more of the mixed dock exception, as I think you are well aware of, is pending before the court. But on April 10th, or on April 11th, we revert to the two-for-one counting that was in place before the court suspended them. So any trips that are straddling that date will be charged one-to-one through April 10th and two-for-one days at sea for the remainder of the trip after April 10th. We, on March 9th, reduced the Eastern Georges Bank cod landing limit to 500 pounds per day at sea, or any part of a day at sea up to 5,000 pounds per trip. And also on March 9th, we increased the Georges Bank yellowtail flounder trip limit from 2,500 pounds per trip to 5,000 pounds per trip. Regarding the sector operation plans for the two sectors, the Georges Bank cod hook sector and Georges Bank cod fixed gear sector, the proposed rules soliciting comments on those were published on February 10th and 12th, respectively. The comment period closed on February 25th and 27th, respectively, and we are completing the final review of both of those final rules and expect to have them implemented on May 1. Regarding the groundfish days at sea leasing program, from May 1st, 2008 through April 2nd, 2009, we processed a total of 662 leases. Of those, 648 were approved. A total number of days at sea leased was 13,996, with an average cost per day at sea leased of $356.43. On April 2nd and 3rd, we mailed to multi-species day at sea allocation permit holders their day at sea allocations for fishing year 2009 that reflect the 18% days at sea reduction. And that was sent to 1,245 vessel owners, and the confirmation of permit history holders will be sent letters soon. Question has arisen as to whether this impacts days at sea carryovers, and it does not. Atlantic sea scallops, regarding Amendment 11 implementation, this is the general category, limited access general category program. We've received about 1,200 applications for all categories, and the deadline for submission was last August 30th. Currently, we have 261 IFQ, 71 Northern Gulf of Maine, and 199 incidental permits issued, with another 176 vessels that have not yet renewed their permit for the 2000 fishing year or have not yet been issued a permit due to noncompliance with VMS requirements. In addition, we issued 56 vessels with certificates of confirmation of permit history, 45 of which are IFQs, and we have approximately 7 appeals still pending at the first level of appeal in the regional office, and 70 that have been referred to the second or hearing level of appeal. There are about 50 vessels now fishing under a temporary letter of authorization while their appeal is pending. On April 1st, the Delmarva scallop access area was closed to the limit access general category scallop fleet, because their allocation of 728 trips into that area was projected to have been taken. Spiny dogfish framework adjustment 2. The proposed rule was published in the Federal Register on March 3rd with a comment period that closed on April 2nd. We're currently completing the final rule. This is the adjustment that allows more flexibility for the councils to adjust to new science and setting biological reference points. It's primarily technical in nature. Also for spiny dogfish, the 2009 proposed specifications were published on March 19th, and the comment period on that closed on April 3rd. The final rule is under review, and we proposed what both this council and the Mid-Atlantic Council recommended to us. The 2009 proposed specifications for Atlantic Bluefish were published on March 2nd, and the comment period closed March 17th. That final rule for the 2009 specifications is also under review. On April 1st, we published the proposed 2009 recreational fishing specifications for summer flounder, scup, and black sea bass, and the comment period on that is still open. It closes on May 1st. And the broad-based sinking ground line requirement for Atlantic trap pot gear under the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Plan became effective April 5th, 2009. And with that implementation, the former Dynamic Area Management Program expired. And finally, on Wolffish, the agency is organizing informational sessions to bring together various fishermen to discuss their knowledge of the Wolffish resource. And those sessions are going to be held in late April or early May in New Bedford, Massachusetts, Gloucester, Massachusetts, and somewhere in Maine. The specific times and dates haven't been confirmed yet, but will be announced shortly. And that completes my report. Thank you.
Questions for Gene? Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. George, could you please repeat the number of Northern Gulf of Maine scallop permits that were issued?
The Northern Gulf of Maine?
Paul Howard.
George, these meetings you mentioned about Wolffish with fishermen, is that, as you know, we've got Wolffish in Amendment 16. Is the purpose of your meetings to gather fishermen's input for scientific purposes or management purposes?
These are being put together by our protected resources group. So this I think has to do with the status determination rather than management per se.
Anyone else? Dr. Pierce.
George, regarding the interim rule, I don't have any figure to reference. I just have the coordinates. Would you happen to know how the 2-to-1 day at sea counting area has been revised for southern New England? You said it's been expanded, but it's unclear to me whether the proposed southern New England closed area is now all 2-to-1 or whether there's some other boundary.
I don't think it's the same area that was proposed. I do have the coordinates, but I don't remember exactly how it changed from the 2-for-1 counting area that's there now. It's not changed greatly, but I can give you the coordinates if you want them.
I've got the coordinates. I just have to apply them to a figure, but okay, it's fine enough. I'll dig deeper into it.
We have figures that are posted on the website also.
Okay, thank you. Also, do you recall if the cap on day at sea leasing for a vessel has been lifted as proposed?
It has been.
It has been? Okay, and then
yes.
Finally, I think you said that you're inviting comments up to May 1 regarding the Black Sea Bass specifications. Did you say that?
That's right, the 2009 recreational specifications for scup, black sea bass, and summer flounder.
Okay, not for the commercial. This is for the
recreational. No, the final specifications were finalized January 1st.
Okay, but the reason why I ask is that I know there are some who would like to see the service entertain some continued discussion about whether or not the numbers should be adjusted upwards, some mid-course corrections, so to speak, in light of the new assessment information from the data pool workshop that indicated we're 90% of the way towards the target. Granted, we're still overfishing, but 90% of the way to the target. And I know that ASMFC staff is, I think, working with center staff, I'm not sure, to further investigate what the quota could have been if indeed we had applied the data pool workshop positive findings, at least relative to the stock size. So is there any chance that the service would entertain revisiting the commercial quota for this year, even though, of course, we are in April?
I think it's unlikely. I wouldn't say absolutely not. But given that we overfishing is occurring and we put the specifications in place January 1st, I think at this point it's pretty late in this year to take any action, but it would have implications for next year, I think.
Anyone else? Sally.
Just a question about Amendment 16 and the agency's review of the draft EIS. What's the time frame for getting that done so that we can kind of understand when the public hearings will take place?
We have to have that document to Silver Spring by April 17th in order for you to begin your process. That's our target, to have the draft EIS to Silver Spring by the 17th, which is a week from Friday. Week from this Friday. So my staff and other parts of the region and the center are working with Tom Neese and the council staff to make whatever changes need to be made to make that happen.
So April 17th is the date where everything is okay from the agency's perspective, everything's okay from the council's perspective. It gets off to Silver Spring, April 17th, then there's enough time to schedule public hearings so that there can be a final decision in June. Is that right?
That's correct.
Anyone else? Okay, no general counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, there's just been two significant decisions by courts relating to litigation matters involving council business. One, of course, you're all very well aware of, and that has to do with the court's most recent order regarding the challenge to Framework 42. The defendants, the government, had moved for the court after receiving the initial order suspending all of Framework 42 to essentially reverse his order on various legal grounds and for practical substantive reasons as well regarding the fishery. The court responded on February 17th by reinstating Framework 42 in all respects except for the provisions relating to the 2-for-1 days at sea counting system. The court suspended for 38 more days those provisions, which means as of, I think it's April 10th, the suspension of the 2-for-1 days will expire. And the court also extended the days at sea leasing 30 days beyond the date that leasing is supposed to end in a given fishing year. The court has also ordered the agency to submit its revised analysis of applicability of the mixed dock exception to the council at this meeting, and basically government defendants are required to report back to the court by April 10th, which is Friday, which we're intending to do. The other lawsuit in which there was a court decision was the Mid-Coast litigation challenging the agency's denial of a petition for emergency and other types of rulemaking to prohibit midwater trawlers from fishing in groundfish closed areas. The plaintiffs had moved to compel the agency to complete the administrative record, which basically means the plaintiffs thought that the administrative record was not complete, that it did not have all of the background information necessary for understanding its decision to deny the petition, and did not, the record did not adequately show the record that supported its decision. And the court denied that motion and held that the, you know, on the face of it, the agency's record seemed adequate, and the action now will is in, or the litigation now is in discussions about the timeframes for submitting dispositive motions in the case, which we anticipate will probably be this summer before the court actually reviews this case. Now, remember, this is a case in which the agency is being challenged on a motion to deny a rulemaking. Even if the judge found in favor of the plaintiffs in this case, that doesn't mean that there's any automatic consequences concerning the herring or groundfish fishery. It only means that a court may require us to reconsider, in light of new information, our denial or take some other action. That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Gene? Okay, thanks, Gene. Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council liaisons.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't attend the last meeting because it overlapped with our meeting, but Aaron went down and he'll give a report from the council meeting. Little bit of business that we had. There was a joint dogfish committee meeting held on March 19th, and the purpose of that meeting is to see whether or not there's enough interest in going ahead with a dogfish amendment. Behind tab 9, there is a committee report from that meeting. I'll just hit the highlights. Considering for the amendment would be research set-aside provision, commercial quota allocation alternatives, to add a biomass rebuilding target, consider allowing for specific trip quotas for different sects of dogfish, so not just a male-only fishery. You could have different quotas for the fish on a trip. Consider adding smooth dogfish to the FMP. This one gets a little tricky, only because it's under HMS right now, and it would take... I'm not sure that one can go forward, but that's there. Consider adding a limited access permit requirement for the possession of spiny dogfish in the EEZ, and recommend that the spiny dogfish recreational fishery be considered in the spiny dogfish FMP. And the committee recommended to the council that they go forward with the amendment and to go out for scoping, and that'll take place at next week's Mid-Atlantic Council meeting. And if they approve that, then they'll start setting up scoping meetings. And I was down there with Dana and Dave Gaethel, so if anybody has any questions.
Any questions? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, just to clarify one thing, Frank, regarding the motions on the biomass rebuilding target, there was some discussion, but the issue was dismissed because what? We will automatically have a change in the biomass rebuilding target as a consequence of the last stock assessment. Is that the way this will play out?
That had to do with the framework, too, which I think George just mentioned. George, do.
Yeah, framework 42 puts in place the mechanism to automatically incorporate new biological reference points. But I think they're due to come out of the stock assessment that's coming up. So presuming the stock assessment can give us a new biological reference point, that would automatically then be incorporated, assuming Framework 2 is finalized by that point, which I expect it will be.
All right, thank you. So I had forgotten that there's going to be a full-blown assessment coming up sometime soon. Is it this spring or this summer? Spiny dogfish? Okay, well, I can wait until June.
It is this year, I think. I think it's the summer.
Yeah, there's a data meeting that has just taken place, and then there's a benchmark meeting scheduled for later this year.
All right, thank you.
Paul Howard.
Yeah,
Frank, on allocating quota to the recreational sector. One is there a actually a directed fishery for record? Do people really want to catch dogfish? Yeah. And two, you're allocating quota based on landings, and when we start talking ACLs and AMs, it's total catch. So it seems like a disconnect to allocate a quota based on landings. You've got to allocate quota based on total catch. But I don't know if that was discussed.
It wasn't so much for the allocation of the quota. It was just when you're considering ALs and ACMs and all that to make sure that because the recreational discard of the fishery is substantial. So they just wanted to make sure that it was given consideration. So you weren't shutting down the entire recreational fishery based on the discard of dogfish. Yeah, so that's a mistake there. All right.
Frank, was there any discussion about, see there was a motion to consider adding a limited access permit. Was there discussion about the interaction of dogfish and just about every other fishery and how that would play out in terms of, you may have a limited access directed permit, I think is what you were thinking about, but accounting for other fisheries that would happen at the ACL level?
It was very early in the process. This is basically just to see if there were ideas for scoping. There wasn't a lot of input on.
Okay. Any other questions from the council? Erling, did you want to add something?
If you like, I can give a Mid-Atlantic report. I have a summary here from our council, your permission. The Mid-Atlantic Council met in Galloway on the 11th through the 13th in February. In addition to addressing future amendment actions, the council also convened a public workshop on bycatch reduction in the Lalago squid fishery, which is a big issue with the butterfish. For the omnibus annual catch limits accountability measures amendment, the council voted to have staff develop and compile options for all council-managed species and create a scoping document prior to meeting again with the ACL-AM committee. The council also voted to remove the ACL-AM issue from Amendment 11 to the Atlantic Mackerel, Squid, and Butterfish Fishery Management Plan and Amendment 14 to the Surf, Clam, and Ocean Quahog FMP, as these issues will now be included in the omnibus ACL-AM amendment. And the Squid, Mackerel, and Butterfish Committee met and finalized a range of alternates to be considered and analyzed for Amendment 11 to the Atlantic Mackerel, Squid, and Butterfish FMP. I won't go into all the little details, but I have them if somebody wants to look at them. And then there was a scoping session for Amendment 14 to the Surf, Clam, and Ocean Quahog FMP. That happened on the evening of February 11th. And then Dr. Paul Rago also presented a report addressing annual discards. I think it's the same report that he gave here at our meeting. And that's basically it. I also want to remind the council that the Mid-Atlantic Council meets next week, next Tuesday, in Duck, North Carolina, which is a very nice area. If you've never been down there, it's on the Outer Banks. And if you have an opportunity, go visit Duck. Thank you.
Okay. I think I was just reviewing the document 2 behind tab 9 at the bottom. It seems to indicate that the discussion at the Joint Committee AP meeting was that the New England Council would go ahead and initiate the amendment ahead of the Mid-Atlantic Council. At least that's what the language is at the bottom of the report. As such, initiation of the amendment at the council level is expected to occur with the New England Council because we just happened to meet before the mid. I don't think we have to do that. I think we can just consider ourselves briefed and wait for the mid to take, you know, initiate the action, unless Paul Howard disagrees. Yeah. Paul?
Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree, but I'd like a little clarification from Gene. It's my understanding that in joint plans, you know, where in the instance of dogfish, where the mid is the lead, they can do most of the work, and the only thing, or they can do the yeoman's share of the work, and the only thing that the New England Council is required to do is stay abreast and provide input where necessary. But legally, the only legal requirement on that is that we vote on the final submission. You know, we don't have to, you know, vote all the way along the line on EIS. We've never in the past voted on DSEISs and things like that. It's only the final vote, and we rely on our committees to provide the input to those plans. And then we vote on the final submission, final approval of the plan.
Well, I think you're correct in that the statute speaks to only the point at which the plan is being voted on at the time of submission. I thought in other joint plans, though, that we did have, you know, like where we are the lead, the Mid-Atlantic does get involved with voting on draft EISs and so forth before they go out, because they will, that helps determine what will be in the final plan. It seems like you would want to be involved in that process.
We always want to, but I'm saying the only legal requirement is that we vote on the final plan. In fact, if you didn't all the way along the line provide that input, you might at the end not get the vote you want. If say, in Monkfish, just say, for instance, in Monkfish, if our council wanted sectors and they voted not to include sectors in terms of, you know, scoping, well, we'd make the decision because we're in the lead to include it and keep it in the document. But so we want their input, but there's no voting along the line that legally, well, you know, talks about what goes
yeah,
forward.
I don't think it's as black and white as you're making it out, Paul, because
I'm sorry, I asked.
The statute actually says that the Secretary may require that the plan and amendment be prepared jointly. Now, preparation includes all the steps along the way, and I think that's the fair reading, that if it's a joint plan, then both councils should be involved throughout the preparation of the plan, not just at the final vote to submit it to the Secretary. Yeah.
You guys can continue that over lunch. As my point was, we don't need to take a vote on this. We've been updated, and I know you have an upcoming meeting, and if we need to take a vote to incorporate it or accept it, we can do that in June. Anything for Frank or Erling? Questions? Okay, moving on. Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Is it Jim or Nancy? Dr. Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start off by updating you on some of the surveys that are ongoing. First of all, there's the Cooperative Monkfish Survey that the center is carrying out cooperatively with the Cooperative Research Program, Population Dynamics Branch, and the Ecosystem Survey Branch. And they are completing field sampling. There are two commercial vessels that are being used for that survey, the Mary Kay and the Endurance. And the survey is going well, and all of the planned survey stations will be completed this month. Then on the spring bottom trawl survey, that's currently underway with the Henry Bigelow. The overall duration of the spring survey as well as the fall survey will go for an extra 2 to 3 weeks, and compared to the length of time that the spring and fall trawl surveys took in the past. And the reason for that is that the station density in the deeper waters has been increased, and this will improve the precision of the estimates of the catches of fish in the deeper water. And the amount of time that it takes to sample in deep water is a lot compared to doing a shallow station, and that accounts for a lot of the increase in time. In addition, the shallower strata that were done in the past that were less than 10 fathoms will no longer be sampled as part of the NEFSC trawl survey. And these stations are sampled by NEMAP and by the state surveys south and north of Rhode Island. And then, let's see. There, in addition to the increased station density that the Bigelow is doing in deeper water, there's also going to be an increase in the number of stations in the western Gulf of Maine. Then, related to the 2009 Sea Scallop Dredge Survey, that will be conducted in from early May until early July using the RV Sharp, as it was last year. And the survey is, the timing of this scallop survey has been moved up so that the data will be available sooner for the PDT process to take place. And this work will be done in cooperation with two scallop RSA-funded projects. Then I wanted to mention the SBRM process a little bit. As you recall, as part of the prioritization process for observers in the SBRM amendment, the way it works is each year the agency is supposed to provide a proposal for their observer coverage according to the SBRM amendment. And Dr. Paul Rago came to both councils in February and presented that proposal. And we got feedback from both of the councils as well as from the regional office. And then there's a document that is handed out. It's under tab 1, number 1. And that's a reply from the agency to those comments explaining the changes that were made in response to the concerns that were raised by both councils and the regional office. And that information was presented to the NRCC a week ago. So, and the changes are now being implemented. So this is a process that will occur annually. Moving on to stock assessment meetings, the next SARC, which will be the first week in June, will have ocean quahogs, tilefish, and weakfish. There will be a calibration meeting, the vessel calibration meeting, scheduled for the end of July or early August. I don't have a hard date for that yet. There are a number of track meetings that are taking place. There's an Eastern Georges Bank cod modeling meeting that just took place. There's another track meeting scheduled for June involving Eastern Georges Bank cod, haddock, and Georges Bank yellowtail, as well as herring. So that will take place in June in Woods Hole. I'm pretty sure it's in Woods Hole, but I have to check that. Then there's a track meeting for dogfish that just took place to look at data issues. This summer or fall, there will be a mackerel meeting to look at data, and that will occur within the track. Then following these data meetings, near the end of this year, there will be track benchmark meetings for both dogfish and mackerel. Then for the fall SARC, which occurs in November, December, we'll have Atlantic surf clams and butterfish on the agenda. And I think that concludes my report. Thank you.
Jim, you, at the top of your report, you mentioned that the Bigelow is no longer going to survey inside of 10 fathom, and then you went on to say that we have NEMAP and we have the state surveys. So to me, that means you're going to rely more heavily on what occurs or what information is collected both through the NEMAP process and existing state surveys. Does that mean that you or the Science Center are comfortable with integrating the information collected in that strata into the assessments?
Well, the state surveys that have been ongoing are already used in a lot of the assessments. I know for sure with the summer flounder and the Mid-Atlantic black sea bass assessments and a few others that they actually bring to the working groups the state data, and those are used as survey indices. The NEMAP data are, that's a new survey. They're only, it's only a little older than a year of having, I believe, a fall and a spring survey. So that's still too short of a time series to actually, it wasn't used in the last stock assessment that was done. But as that survey grows in length, it will certainly be used in that fashion. And it's going to, this comes up often, but it's going to be used as a separate piece of information. It's not going to be calibrated against the Bigelow to try to link those two as a single database. It'll be a separate index of abundance for the inshore areas that it samples. I think Nancy had her hand up too.
Yeah, before I get to Nancy. So that means that, and I appreciate you differentiating between existing state surveys and NEMAP. That means that we are relying 100% on the state surveys for those nearshore strata. You have no other source of survey information, right?
That's right for surveys, but there will also still be the other kinds of data that have always been collected for those waters on commercial catches, what's being taken, catch at age, all of that. The way a lot of the assessments are moving, they're much more integrated, so they don't rely so much on a single survey as they did in the past. And when a piece of information drops out of one survey, when a lot of other pieces of information are also going into the stock assessment, it's not as crucial. But, I mean, your point is well taken, and I'm sure adjustments will have to be made, especially for species that really tend to occur close to the coast.
Okay. Nancy?
One thing about the NEMAP survey and the timing of the information and its availability and integration into the assessments. The NEMAP survey has actually gone through a peer review. So I know that we've been talking about the development of a time series and, you know, the comfort or the confidence in the data requiring minimally 3 years. But I think since it's been through this peer review, we need to probably take a really hard look at what data are available earlier rather than later. So even though at this point in terms of nearshore, inshore information, we are relying obviously on the state surveys, I think because of the peer review that NEMAP has gone through, and obviously the peer review came out and said that it was an appropriate survey, it was being done properly, and the information is good information, then we probably need to rethink integrating that information, like I said, sooner rather than later.
Well, that's helpful. I'm glad to hear that. Anybody have any questions for Jim or Nancy? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Jim, you mentioned that there was a track on dogfish data issues. So the U.S. and the Canadian counterparts got together and they dealt with this particular important part of the assessment, availability of data, the quality of data. Were any problems identified? Can we expect that the track will move forward without our having a problem with a lack of information, especially on the Canadian side?
Well, I was not at the track meeting. I was at another meeting that week, so I don't have any personal anything to report to you to answer that. I know the meeting took place, and I heard from Dr. Rago that there was a large group of Canadians who participated in the meeting, and I think there is some discussion about when the about scheduling for the next meeting. That date has really been hard to pin down, but that's really all I have for you.
David.
Yes, Jim, you mentioned that you're doing a station density in deeper water is increased. What is defined as deeper water?
~110 meters to ~360 meters.
Okay, so it's quite a large swath of the shelf then. And has any thought been given to how that information is going to be integrated into the assessments yet, or is that an ongoing process?
Well, the stations are actually in existing strata. As you know, this is a stratified random sampling design. So those outer stations had low coverage before, and now they'll have more replicates within each station, which will increase the precision. But I don't think that it will require a different kind of analysis. It's simply that you have more data now to work with.
Jim, what is the status of the monkfish industry survey, and what is the next steps once that's completed?
Well, as I mentioned, the survey is going well. I think that unlike the last monkfish survey, which went on, this one is supposed to be completed by early April. And the plan is to have the data analyzed, and for SARC 50, which will be in June of 2010, monkfish is on the agenda. So that will be a benchmark assessment, including those data.
Anyone else? Ron?
There we go. I thought that was a coordinated effort to cut public comment. Ron Smolowitz, Fishery Survival Fund. Just two points. Over the years, one problem we were concerned about from a habitat perspective is calibrating inshore sampling gear to the nymphs gear, for example, for juvenile codfish. When it comes to a lot of the habitat questions regarding juvenile cod, we have no idea of how to compare, let's say, the Massachusetts inshore survey to the federal survey. And now there's going to be no overlap at all. It could be problematic. I would suggest that there needs to be some gear comparison work. Now, it might not be important for the assessment, but it's going to certainly be important for the juveniles of many species that aren't caught in the commercial fisheries to determine the most important grounds or the most important nursery areas. So I would just make the recommendation that, it's been made before, that we do some cross comparison of the sampling gears. Is there any plans to do that?
I don't know exactly, but I think that would be down the road. Right now they're focusing on the calibration data set that they have, but those kinds of studies are certainly reasonable to suggest, and we can talk about it. But I'd have to discuss that with Wendy and Russ.
And then the other thing that I had noticed during the 3 years that I was on the Albatross is that the gear seems to be less efficient in the deep water stations. Now, I know it's instrumented, but I certainly think that you guys might want to be a little bit concerned. It comes back to when you're trying to compare where the most important areas are for things like bond or skate or monkfish or flatfish. Because you have lower numbers in the survey in the deeper water doesn't necessarily mean there's less fish there. I just, for whatever the reasons, not to discuss them now, you might want to be concerned about that. It was just a suggestion.
Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Kalin with Lund's Fisheries. Jim, I just want to ask you a question. I guess I ask you this at least once a year. What's the forecast for the starting up an acoustic program for pelagics with the Bigelow? I know you've been busy with the groundfish aspect of what you're doing with that vessel, but can we look forward to some acoustic survey time in the near future for mackerel and herring abundance?
And you always catch me off guard on that, and I still don't know. Perhaps Nancy has a better read on that, but I will ask this time so that next year I'll have an answer.
Well, hopefully one of these years we'll actually get it done. So, and I know the thing had that big echo sounder installed and so forth, so we're looking forward to getting that started, and thank you.
So are we. I mean, we always put it on the schedule for our ships and our surveys. And then for whatever reasons, and it's usually getting bumped by something else in funding and all of that, that we tend to not do it. But I have to tell you that what we're doing with the Bigelow is getting all the equipment on it tested. And hopefully, at least we'll know that we have the capability of doing it. And quite frankly, the use of the acoustics is really gaining some serious traction in NOAA across the board. And, of course, all the new vessels have all this great capability, and it's a matter of why did we ask for it? So we're in the process on the Bigelow now of making sure that we can use the equipment, that it will operate as we hope it will and think it will. And we have been doing some testing of it. So the plan is to try to do that survey this year, but again, there's never any guarantees, as you know. But I think that, quite frankly, like I said, within fisheries and NOAA, there's much more interest in doing it. So I think the likelihood of it occurring, maybe not this year, but certainly in the near future, is pretty high.
Yeah, thanks. We all know that acoustics are used to do abundance indices for pelagics all around the world, particularly in Europe. And we're also looking forward to continuing to develop some inshore acoustic survey capability in the Gulf of Maine, too. We've talked about it for a long time, so I appreciate you staying focused on it. Thank you.
Back to the council. Anything further for Jim or Nancy? Okay, seeing none. U.S. Coast Guard.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. Morning, everybody. This is the Coast Guard report for February and March of 2009. During that two-month period, we conducted 259 fisheries boardings. Of the 259 boardings, there were 18 fisheries violations issued. Of the 259 boardings, 72 commercial fishing vessels were issued safety violations. The most common safety violations continue to be expired flares and visual distress signals, expired hydrostatic releases on the survival craft, expired hydrostatic releases and batteries on EPIRBs. Two commercial fishing vessel voyages were terminated. They were in such rough safety shape that we had to actually send those two boats home, one up off of Maine and one down off of New York. Safety-wise, 119 vessels applied for a commercial fishing vessel safety decal, and 91 decals were issued. So 91 of the 119 boats successfully completed. It's about 3 out of 4. Vessel casualties. 21 reported casualty cases during the period. 12 were equipment casualties. 3 vessels ran aground. 1 vessel reported itself taken on water, but the flooding was controlled and the vessel didn't sink. 5 other vessels sank, 4 while they were at the moorings and 1 that was underway. There were 2, regrettably, lives lost this period. The fishing vessel All-American, which is a sea urchin boat up off of Lubeck, Maine, that remains under investigation. Marine casualties being done. 1 body was recovered. 1 body never was. We conducted 4 medevacs, the America, the Amy Philbrick, the Princess Laura, and the Persistence. All benefited from a helicopter taking injured crewmen back for medical assistance. And then I've got a few slides to show you here today. You stole it, Tim. Good. Yeah. This is, if you remember at the last council meeting, I talked a little bit about EPIRBS, and we said that the satellites were no longer monitoring 121.5 and 243 direction-finding EPIRBS. We were only monitoring 406 EPIRBS. And so the question is, well, can you still DF on an EPIRB? And the answer to that is, yes, we can. And we've got some new equipment that we're fielding Coast Guard-wide that I just wanted to call your attention to. That's a picture of a jet, right? Please note there's not a picture of a helicopter because this equipment is only in the Falcon jets right now. It's not in the helicopters yet. Go ahead to the next slide. Kind of a busy slide, but what it says, if you're in the back of the room, is we're real happy with this new direction finding equipment that we've got out on all of our Falcons right now. 47 lives saved Coast Guard wide and a bunch of them here at Cape Cod. The white case is the Donna Marie, the waterproof Symphony 1, Pandora 2. Those are all boats from our fleet here in New England that have benefited from us having this new direction finding equipment on the Falcon. Just so you understand, we put it on the Falcons first because typically when we have an EPIRB case, the Falcon is the first thing we'll fly on it. The Falcon can get a lot of altitude, which means it can hear that EPIRB from a long ways away. Right? So if you have a good strong battery in your EPIRB and you're putting out a good signal, we can get that Falcon up high, and we've locked on to EPIRBs. I think one of them is 137 miles away. That's pretty good. That's going to cut down that search time in the old search and rescue. It's going to get you out of the water faster and get us to the right spot. Typically, we send that jet out first. It's going to find wherever the EPIRB is, and that's going to vector a helicopter straight in. So that helicopter doesn't lose time in the search process. It just comes right in and does a rescue. Right? We're real happy with these. We've got them on all of the Falcons that are stationed at Cape Cod. And by the summer of 2010, we're supposed to have them on all the H-60s, the helicopters that are stationed at Cape Cod, too. So we're real pleased with these. 406 is the way to go. And again, has been for 10 years. It's not really a new thing. It's just the satellite systems are no longer monitoring for 121 or 243. That's all I've got. If you have any questions, be happy to take them.
Really?
Captain McGinnis, recently we had a sinking off Cape May, New Jersey, with a loss of 6 lives.
Yes.
A vessel called the Lady Mary. And reading the local newspaper and reports, NOAA had a ship out, identified a target on the ocean floor that had the profile of the Lady Mary, or similar size. And there was the Coast Guard was supposed to go back out with a camera and see if they could verify if it was the Lady Mary and see if there was some information they could use in their inquiry to see what went wrong. Apparently what happened pretty quick. Do you have anything new on that? Because that's all I know.
Erling, I don't have any specifics for you. What I can tell you is what the 5th District has done with that case, because it's so similar to a striking number of other cases that we've had in New England and in the 5th District recently, is instead of doing a marine casualty, they've convened a Marine Board of Investigation. Okay, There's a high loss of life involved with that boat, six people, right? And it's also real similar to something's happening real quickly, boats are rolling over real fast, and there's a trend there, we think. It's just administrative, a Marine casualty versus a Marine Board of Investigation, but by convening the Marine Board and getting the Commandant's concurrence to do that, that means the 5th District will have a lot more resources available to them in terms of research time, in terms of people, and in terms of money to go ahead and do an investigation, a thorough investigation on the Lady Mary, and hopefully come to some conclusion as to what caused that vessel to capsize.
And I think they have scheduled, second question would be, they have scheduled a board, and I think it was postponed, waiting the results of the submersible going out and trying to get information on this to see what else they could learn from this. Do you know if this has been rescheduled? I'd be interested if this happened, held in our area, I would be interested in attending.
You bet. A Marine Board of Investigation is not a discrete event. It will be a number of events that take place over the better part probably of a year, between some hearings, some information gathering sessions, and then analysis of data and things like that, right, depending on what we can find out. So whereas they may have put together a date where they plan to take an ROV out and do a dive, just like fishing, we're at the mercy of the weather. So you can have a trouble with the vessel that's going to take you out. You can have trouble with the weather, you know, it's like a lot of other things. They'll get out there and they'll get it done for sure. And if you make sure I've got a good ID for you afterwards, and I'll make sure your name gets through to the folks that are running the board, and they'll be able to contact you, let you know what's going on.
Thank you.
David?
Yes, I have two questions. One I'm asking actually on behalf of the governor of my state, because he asked me and I didn't know the answer. And it was in regards to the kayaker that drowned off New Hampshire, or apparently drowned, he disappeared. Is there a policy for terminating recreational voyages similar to the one for commercial voyages, you know, i.e. a manifestly unsafe condition? And if there is, could you kind of tell the audience what it might be? That would be my first question.
Yes, there is. We can terminate the voyage of a recreational vessel if it's determined to be manifestly unsafe. Okay, but in order to do that, you know, we have to have some pretty strong articulable reasons why we think it's manifestly unsafe. In the particular case with this kayaker, we knew that there was heavy weather coming in later, but this person seemed very competent, seemed to be well-equipped, seemed to know what he was doing, and had a plan that looked like it would work out.
Okay, so the answer is there is a policy, so I can get back to him, because the reason he asked is apparently he actually knew the guy.
Yes.
So I do have to get back to him. The second question I had is, do you have any updates on the sinking of the Patriot? Is there any more information available on that yet?
No, the process continues, Dave. The two processes continue, the Marine casualty investigation and then search and rescue case study. They're both ongoing.
Frank?
Thank you. Yeah, I have a question. It's been rumored or threatened since the early 1990s, and I understand that in the President's budget, Loran C is to be turned off. Is there an update on that, or do you think it will be, or is it still going to be rumored?
I think it's still rumors at this point. We've been proposing for a long time to turn it off. But I really don't have. If it's in, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, I'll bring you information at the next meeting. And Frank, I can certainly get it to you sooner than that.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, I'd like it if you could at the next meeting have something to present on that.
You bet.
Thank you. Anyone else? Thanks, Joe. Enforcement VMS.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everybody. Good to see you again. In the last quarter, the NOAA Office of Law Enforcement conducted 12 catch seizures, totaling $34,700 and change. Thanks. I wanted to highlight two cases this morning. Bill Semro is not with me today. He's in training. The number of EMS units is pretty steady. It's still at 1,292 units total. There's been quite a bit of chatter about two cases that are being prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney in federal court in Boston involving endangered species and marine mammal takes, both involving humpback whales. And I understand there's a good deal of concern in the industry about our policy on prosecuting takes of marine mammals. I just want to make it clear that we are not going to recommend prosecution for de minimis cases. However, the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Act Protection Act are very clear in that a take, being any kind of behavior that modifies an animal's behavior, or its feeding, or its breeding, or its living, is a violation. We will recommend prosecution for cases that involve negligence or recklessness. So if a fisherman is in an area and there is an accidental take, and everything that is possible and reasonable is done in the actions before and during and after the take, I would not anticipate a criminal prosecution. But in cases where there is a blatant disregard for the animal, that is a strong possibility. The second thing I'd like to talk about is our observer actions. In the last quarter, we had 33 complaints from the Northeast Observer Program, which resulted in 8 cases being forwarded to General Counsel for prosecution. 33 is a pretty high number. I would like to see more compliance. We're working with the industry in trying to get voluntary compliance, and I hope that in the future that number, 33 and a quarter, will go down substantially. I've come to think of my friend Maggie Raymond as the Grim Reaper, because every morning I open up my email and Maggie's forwarded me some more interesting articles in the press, most of which are not very complimentary to NOAA law enforcement. And I'd like to just give you folks some facts, and then you can assess what you believe and what you don't believe that you read. I put together some statistics on what we've done in the last 3 years. And here's an article. I don't know if you can see it from here. This is reprinted from a Commercial Fisheries News with their permission. Following a series of events, which includes the economy, the sinking of the Patriot, and the charging of the Gloucester Seafood Display Auction with 57 counts of violations, the circumstances kind of conspired into a perfect storm for media hysteria. And in Commercial Fisheries News, there's an accurate summary of a letter that was sent to some federal legislators by 18 state legislators in Massachusetts. And in that letter and in some other correspondence, it was alleged that NOAA special agents push people around, use foul language, deny people their opportunity or their right to seek legal counsel. We are overzealous, heavy-handed, intimidating, and vindictive. And we coerce people into giving up their catch when they've done nothing wrong. Regarding the behavior of special agents, if any of these kind of allegations are true, I need to know about them. And to date, a lot of criticism has been made, but I do not know of any specific examples of that kind of unprofessional behavior. And there's a number of ways to report it if it occurs. You're welcome to call me. You're welcome to call any special agent who, by policy, need to report those kind of reports from the public. If one wants to do it anonymously, which we don't encourage, but it's possible, it can be done via our webpage. That being said, I'm unaware of this kind of behavior. I've questioned the supervisors who work for me, and I've been assured that it has not taken place. But things do happen, and if in the future you ever hear about it, I really need to know about it, because I will say right here, right now, we will not tolerate anything but professional behavior by our special agents. They've got a lot of authority and a lot of responsibility, and to date, they've always handled that with professionalism and grace, and we expect that to continue. As you know, we have 13 field stations in 10 coastal states, 43 major seaports, 12 major seafood exchanges, 22 major international airports, and a number of international ports on the Canadian border. I put together some statistics just to put things in perspective. In 2008, last year, there were 5,400 federally permitted vessels, and those vessels made 128,266 trips. Of those 128,000 plus trips, we opened investigations on 498 of those trips. Suspected violations, not all of them were violations. Certainly not all of the violations that occurred were referred for prosecution. Of those 498 investigations that we opened, General Counsel for Enforcement and Litigation issued 111 NOVAs to 2.04% of the total fleet. Now, those 111 NOVAs totaled $899,000, less than $1 million, which is less than 1% of the amount landed in the period, which was $713,474,000. So less than 1% of the total value was subject to NOVA. And to put that in a graphic format, on the left, you see the number of fishing trips for the 3 years. Each color is a different year. The second is the number of vessels. The third column is the number of cases, and the fourth column is the NOVAs that were issued. So it's a very small percentage, and I think what this shows is the vast majority of the people in the industry are following the rules. So to think that we're out there targeting everybody for everything is just not the case. And in addition to that last column of NOVAs, there's a small percentage of cases that go criminally. And in 3 years, we prosecuted, or the U.S. Attorney's Office has prosecuted, 63 cases for criminal violations, and none of those 63 cases involved Magnuson-type violations. They were all either smuggling or Lacey Act or endangered species, things like that. And that concludes my report. I'd be happy to take questions.
Questions for Andy? Paul Howard?
A couple questions, Andy. The first one, and Gene could jump in. I think threatening or assaulting or interfering with the duties of an observer is a criminal penalty. I think it's that serious that Magnuson has it as a criminal penalty. And as you know, we should be very concerned about all those violations coming up as we're moving towards more and more monitoring and observing. So what was the nature of those violations?
I can
tell you
that.
The second question is, with the, the heavy-handed enforcement and stuff, there was some mention of the states, one particular state, looking at the appropriateness of the agreement where federal money is given to the states to enforce federal regulations. What is the status of that with the five states, and have you seen any decline in performance based on recent press?
Thanks. Two good questions. On the last page of the enforcement report is an in-depth description of all the observer issues that we had this quarter. There were observer refusals. There was some interference. There were some safety complaints. There was a gear tampering complaint, and most of them were refusals. And just a clarification on your accurate comment about these being criminal violations. Typically, we've gone civil on these violations, just because it's a better system for us. It's easier, it's cleaner and faster. However, in the case of a real serious violation, we do have the option of going criminally, and the day may come when we have to do that. Hopefully it won't. Your second question pertained to the joint enforcement program, in which we funnel money from Congress through the Office of Law Enforcement directly to the 10 coastal states in the Northeast. The money is used for state officers to do federal enforcement work, and it gives us hundreds of uniformed officers working on our behalf, because remember, there are 30 some odd special agents in the Northeast. They do investigations, more detective work than patrol work, and the joint enforcement program has given us people to be dockside, board boats, go out on patrol, be visible, and it's worked very well. I don't have the statistics on the number of cases that have been brought to us by the state officers, but that's available if you're interested. Recently, an article in the Gloucester Daily Times criticized that program. The criticism was not very specific, and I don't want to speculate on what the author was getting at. However, I have talked to my counterparts in the states who were affected by that statement, and there's been no decrease in the amount of effort going forth. We haven't changed our policy or our posture in using the state officers, and I don't anticipate that we will. There has been a call for an independent investigation of that program. In fact, there has been a call for an independent investigation of the Office of Law Enforcement by the Inspector General's office. I don't know if that will occur or not. I can tell you if it does occur, we are, of course, going to cooperate fully with that investigation, as we're required to. And in fact, I look forward to that kind of scrutiny, because I'm really confident that the closer people look at the law enforcement program in the Northeast, the better we will look. We try very hard for excellence. We are an accredited agency. We're accredited to use the best professional law enforcement practices recognized worldwide, and I'd welcome scrutiny from the Inspector General, certainly from council members, and from the industry.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very supportive of the JAA program. State of Maine's benefited well, and we have over 50 officers and about a dozen boats that participate in a number of joint enforcement actions with NOAA law enforcement. But a couple questions, Andy. One is, how do you plan to enforce the new sinking ground line rule?
We are going to enforce the new sinking ground line rule in several ways. We are the first way and the best way for us to do that is public education. And we've made a real effort over the last year to tell people what's expected of them and to help them comply with it. We're going to enforce it in three ways. One is by patrol, using state officers and, to some extent, the Coast Guard. The second way we're going to do it is by investigating specific instances in which a take occurs. And if a take occurs, the scrutiny of the gear and the forensics that we're going to use to determine whether or not the gear is compliant is going to be more in-depth than it would be in a patrol. To put it very simply, if you throw a piece of rope in a bucket and it sinks, it's probably sinking rope. If it floats, that's a clue also that maybe it's not compliant. And, of course, the third way we're going to do it is by listening to what people are telling us as far as violations and compliance can be reported.
Thanks. And actually a follow-up on Paul's comments about the observer program. 33 complaints is a heck of a lot in 3 months when we're moving down the road of sectors and ACLs and AMs where we need monitoring and compliance. So I hope that that your office will vigorously pursue these so that we can bring the industry together and to have some compliance. We can have some faith in what we're all proposing and planning to do.
Thanks, Terry. And just a little food for thought on the 33. You know, that is a high number, and I've stated that I hope we can get a lower number in the future. Part of the reporting might be due to our outreach efforts, and I find that the observer program and the observers are a lot more likely to communicate with law enforcement than they were historically. So we've encouraged the dialogue, and the dialogue's working, and for better or for worse, that's resulted in a higher statistic. However, that statistic might not indicate that the problems are that great, but we're going to strive to bring it down more.
I hope you're right, because we all have a lot at stake here.
Mary Beth? Rodney?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would just like to say in New Bedford we have a lot of agents, and the agents in New Bedford are very professional. They go out of their way to help fishermen answer some questions. I know several fishermen that have had questions and gone up to their agency, and they've helped them walk through their agency. It's just like riding down the road and a state trooper pulls you over, not because you're speeding, because he had a bad day with his wife that morning. That's the way it happens. It's not that you broke the law. It's that he had a bad day. So I think people carry that message. I have one thing with the observer program. I think they need a little bit of education when it comes to safety. We've had 3 calls of EPIRBs. They check them when they go make the trip, and they've dropped them out of the cases. One of those calls ended up in being a broken antenna. That vessel made 1 trip with the observer aboard with the EPIRB not working, and a 2nd trip with a crew aboard wasn't working. We caught it on the next trip when we did our monthly exam. And like I say, we've had 3 cases like that in New Bedford just in a short time. So I think maybe, I don't know if I need to sit with Amy and work that out, because those EPIRBs are spring-loaded. And it depends where they're mounted. And if an observer's not familiar with it and he pulls that pin, it comes flying out and it drops down. So, thank you.
Rodney, I've had similar complaints in my office with that and with the life rafts. They get up on the roof of our boats and start jiggling around the hydrostatic release and everything else. And there's some concern on the part of the captains that these individuals don't necessarily know what they're doing. Jimmy?
I got one question here in the observer thing. What is gear tampering complaint? What is that? I just don't know. What does an observer have to do with gear tampering?
I don't know. I was wondering that as I was reviewing this before. I didn't write this report. It was reported to me.
Okay.
I don't know what that refers to.
And I just make a statement. I happened to be talking to some agents in Portland yesterday, and I want to say that my experience with them over the long number of years have been that they're very professional and trying to do the best job that they can. I think one issue we have is the complexity of the rules. I mean, they're running to catch up half the time, as we are. You know, it's just difficult. So, but I've found them, even if we had a violation with somebody, that it was done professionally. So.
Thanks. We expect that. And one more comment. I recognize that when people are frustrated with the complex regulations that no one can deny, and when they're frustrated with the agency or with anything having to do with the industry, the special agents in the field are the visible part of NOAA. They don't see all the hard work that everybody else in NOAA in fisheries is doing, but here are the agents, and they people are often not glad to see us because it is an adversarial kind of relationship that we have with our clients. So we take a lot of the heat for general frustration. And I recognize that. But that being said, we strive to be professional, and I expect that from them.
Anything further? Dave Gatham.
Yeah, Andy, I'm glad you've acknowledged that there's a perception of a problem out there, because that's, as we all know in politics, perception can become reality real fast. And it seems to me that the perception of our problem seems to revolve consistently around two issues, most of which this council has created. One is trip limits. It is almost impossible to weigh fish at sea. I bought a gravity-compensated scale. It's a very expensive piece of equipment to weigh my fish. I can weigh them, your agent can weigh them, and neither one of us is going to get the same weight twice. It simply can't be done. Weights cannot be calculated on a moving vessel, even with a gravity-compensated scale. So the solution to this, to me, is to get away from weight limits and go to some kind of volumetric measure. You know, two standard fish boxes with the covers snapped on, and whatever the weight is, it is, instead of having poundage limits for trip limits. That's one area where people are consistently having problems. You come in with what you think is 8 boxes of cod, and it turns out to be 8.5 boxes, and that's a violation. And the second is a list of documents that are required to fish in any given area. That seems to be another problem that we consistently run into. Quite frankly, fishermen are being deluged with paperwork from the regional office. Every day I go home and my mailbox is crammed full. Granted, I have multiple permits, so I get multiple mailings. But, a lot of people just simply don't read the stuff they get. And I know that's their fault. They should read it. But the fact is they get so much of it and they just can't. So what we need is very clear-cut list. If you're fishing in the Western Gulf of Maine, differential county area, you need the following. Those types of lists, things people could check off and say, okay, I got a vessel permit that's current. I got an operator permit that's current. I need a yellowtail exemption letter if you needed one. I need a monkfish exemption letter if I need one. I need a transfer at sea permit if I transfer fish at sea. All the things that you're required, because quite frankly, a lot of these guys don't know anymore. I mean, I had a number of people call me in the last couple of weeks and say, thank God you kept bugging us about those yellowtail letters, because if you hadn't bugged us, we wouldn't have them, and we'd be on the list of the 59 violations or whatever it is for yellowtail. They just simply don't understand. To them, it's a piece of paper. It means nothing, quite frankly. And I know it's very important for enforcing the law, but to the average fisherman, most people get into fishing in the first place because they couldn't ever deal with paper. And what do they get, 20 years down the road? Their mailboxes probably get more mail than anybody on the street. And so we need to find a way to solve this issue, because Andy's people are doing their job. They're writing violations for people not having a piece of paper. That's their job. But by the same token, we've got to find a way to convince people that they really got to get that piece of paper. So I would hope that Andy's people and the regional office staff could start working together to find some more effective means of communication with fishermen than the blizzard of deer permit holder letters that go out every day. Once it gets to be more than a couple of paragraphs long, I can watch people pick these things up. Their eyes glaze over and they go, yeah, whatever, and they throw it in the trash. You can say, well, it's their fault, and it clearly is, but it's also our fault, and we should acknowledge that and find a way to fix it.
Anything further? Okay, thanks, Andy. Anybody wishing to bring forward ASMFC information? Dr. Pierce.
There are two issues to raise, actually updates as to where we stand with a few species that are near and dear to this council's heart. And the first is winter flounder. Obviously, winter flounder is the focus of the interim action by the service, and that's clear from the cover of the EA that has a big winter flounder on it. So you can't escape the fact that it's directed towards winter flounder. You may recall that at the February ASMFC meeting, the Winter Flounder Management Board decided to initiate a so-called fast-track addendum for winter flounder for final action at our May meeting, which is coming up in the not-too-distant future, in a few weeks, really. Public hearings have been scheduled. on this particular document. And in Massachusetts, I believe, there's one on April 23rd. The other states have a public hearing scheduled, too. I don't know what those are offhand, but ours is on the 23rd. And the document deals with a number of options related to how to cut fishing mortality in the recreational fishery and the commercial fishery for winter flounder, Gulf of Maine, southern New England, mid-Atlantic. Some of the options are quite consistent with, compatible with the interim action and what has been, what will be implemented by the National Marine Fisheries Service, some not so much. But it's a good range of options for the recreational fishery and for the commercial fishery. I suspect that after the public hearings are held, the board at our May meeting will reflect on all of that public comment and will reflect on two other things, of course, what will be implemented through the interim action and also what the New England Fishery Management Council wants to have implemented for winter flounder in those two different areas based upon the existing position of this council, which is not the same as the National Marine Fisheries Service. So it'll be interesting discussion to say the least, and again, that is in May. The next item of business that ASMFC will take on is not so much for the organization itself, but more for one element of it, and that's the sea herring section that Terry Stockwell chairs. As this council knows, the section continues to play, and of course ASMFC as a whole, continues to play a very important role in management, regulation of the sea herring fishery. It's a good partnership. Basically, the numbers are set by the council, the federal government, and then the states figure out how to make it work. And we have spawning closures and days out of the fishery. And we work very closely with the fishing industry, which is an essential element of how we, the states, deal with management of sea herring regionally in an interstate way. There's a meeting coming up on, let's see here. I thought I had it on the tip of my tongue. I guess I don't.
I think it's May 21. May 21?
May 20, well, I got May 8th. Maybe it's the wrong date. Anyways, in May, stay tuned. In May, there will be a meeting of the section with the industry to once again discuss the way in which we should begin this fishery in Area 1A specifically. That is, what should the days off be, all the while our objective being to try to spread the quota out for as long as possible, recognizing it's 45,000 tons or so, not exactly that. That pretty much, I believe, covers ASMFC actions that are impending.
Terry.
Thank you, David. One additional item of interest to this council is a river herring amendment, which the commission will be voting on at the May meeting. The commission was unable to deal with a document about as thick as our binder, and referred it to a working group. The working group's been sifting through the different elements of it, have a proposal to go back to the full board, and so we should be able to have a report back to the council at sometime at our June meeting.
Anything further under ASMFC?
Mary Beth?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question to Terry as the chairperson of the section. Does the section intend to participate in this upcoming specification process jointly with the council?
Good question, Mary Beth. I don't have the answer to that. Conditionally, yes, but I haven't thought through. We're about to change chairs. Representative Abbott from New Hampshire will be the new chair. So let's talk after at, you know, let's talk on break.
Anything further? David?
Yes, I just had one announcement, Mr. Chairman. I figured it's a good time to give it. I have been working with a group from the European Union who have been over here fact-finding for best practices, and I think this council will be interested to know that we are actually held up as one of the representations of best practices. Please don't laugh too hard. The EU is reauthorizing its common fisheries policy, which is widely seen as not working, and they're looking to implement a regional management council system, perhaps at least at a pilot level in the Baltic Sea. And to that end, if people are interested, there's a website you can go to. It is www.balticsea.2020.org, and that'll bring you to a live website of a number of presentations that were given in Brussels last week by prominent fisheries ministers of the EU and by yours truly, quite frankly. Way out of my class there. It's basically presentations on best practices, what works and what doesn't. And in my case, it's from my personal perspective, so you may not all agree with it, but at least you'll see what I presented. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Our upcoming annual council chairs meeting, which will be in Boston in May, the theme is best practices. So seems like a lot of people are talking about that. David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could that website be put on the links list in the council website, the list of links?
I'd like to take a look at it before we decide to link to it. I mean, okay. I don't know what's in it, but, we can.
If it's appropriate, we could do that.
Yeah, we'll take a look at it. Anything further under ASMFC? Okay, we'll take a break. We'll come back and talk about EFPs. Before lunch.